If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses, plus free delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number. To a good life's sleep.
Welcome to the Ladies of Liverpool podcast.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
Ladies of Liverpool. With Leanne Campbell.
It is, of course, Ladies of Liverpool, the podcast that we know you love to tune into week after week. We've been going for years and years and years and years before podcasts were even trendy. And you've been there, a lot of you, since the very start, from way back when, from our very first Swingers episode right through to today, when we have got a very special guest. For the first time, we're going to speak to somebody who has been on the receiving end of a heart transplant. We're asking all the questions that you want to know. This story really is important. So please listen, take away the message and everything you learn from this. Sit back, relax. It's Ladies of Liverpool with lovely Jodie. Jodie, I'm going to start at today. You're sitting here with us looking the inch of perfection. You've got a sparkle in your eye, your skin's glowing. You would never dream in a month of Sundays that your body has been through what it's been through. So today you're healthy, yes?
Oh God, yes. Yeah, amazing.
Okay,
yeah.
And you've got a heart that you wasn't born with.
Yeah.
That was donated. Yes. And that's your message today. It's about everybody thinking about putting themselves on the donor list?
On the donor list, yeah. Okay. How important it is, yeah.
So this heart that's pumping in your chest right now,
yes.
When did you receive it?
It was November last year. So it's only been just on 6 months.
And those first 6 months, I imagine, are quite important to make sure your body doesn't reject it.
Well, the first 12 months is like your crucial time.
Okay.
The first 6 months, you're getting regular biopsies and things like that to make sure you're not rejecting it. And I'm on anti-rejection medication and things like that. So, but touch wood, I've actually been brilliant. Like heart-wise, I'm okay. I had a lot of problems after the transplant.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up in a coma for 3.5 weeks.
Oh, wow, Jesus.
And got put on ECMO, which is like a machine basically that was pumping. My heart wasn't pumping when I first got it.
Yeah.
So we got it on the 5th of November and it didn't pump properly until the 11th. So I was on this machine. So like my blood was going into the machine, pumping around it, coming back into my body. And that was basically what was keeping me alive. And I got multiple organ failure and I got sepsis all at once. So I had to get put in this coma. And it was just...
Talk to me about them, those couple of days. Before we go right back to the start, because it's such an interesting story, talk to me about those moments. You get the phone call to say, we've got a heart for you. How long had you waited for?
So I went on the list in June last year, but I was on the routine list, so I was still at home with my family and things. And it was just, obviously, if you get a phone call, you had to go in. So I did actually get a phone call in August, went in, got prepped for surgery and everything, and then it fell through. I had to go back home.
And what did they tell you why it falls through?
No, they're not allowed. Can't tell you anything. They just said it fell through.
Imagine it'd be all
it's more than likely because obviously they've received the heart and they've looked at it and they've gone, do you know what? There might be a slight problem with that. We don't even want to chance it.
Yeah.
It might be that the family have gone, no, like they haven't told us that they want to be an organ donor, so we're not giving them. And that is one of the messages of today, is to make sure your family knows. If your family doesn't know, if you don't have the conversation with your family about I'm on the organ donor list and if I was to pass away, I want my organs to go to anywhere where they're needed. If your family don't know that, they can actually pull you out of being. It's their decision because you're no longer here.
I did not
know
that.
Yeah, so that can actually be a case where you can get there, be prepped, and then the family of the other person say, actually, no, we don't
want that. I take a breath moment 3 minutes into the podcast. I'm like holding my breath going, hang on, we haven't even started. I did not know that.
So that can be a thing, which I didn't know at the time. But that could have, I don't know what the reason was, but that could have been one of the reasons.
Yeah.
And you just don't know, and they're not allowed to tell.
And how disappointing if that is someone's wish as well.
I know.
How do you have that person? What do we do?
Well, to be honest with you now, it's actually a new thing. I don't know how many years it's been out for. It's actually a newer thing that everybody's on the donor list and you've got to opt out.
Okay.
Where it used to be you had to opt in, but they've changed the law.
Yeah.
But even though everyone's on it and you don't opt out, your family need to know that you're on it.
So that's all you need to do.
And that's the main thing. You've got to have the talk with your family to say, I'm on the organ donor list and I want my organs to go. Some people might say, I don't want my eyes to go anywhere. I don't want, but you can state that. You can actually go on the organ donor register. You can log into your own thing and you can put down, right, I want to give my heart, my lungs, my liver, whatever, but I don't want to give anything else. You can actually state what you want to give, but your family needs to know.
I want everyone listening to do me a favour right now. I want you to click the share button, however you listen to this podcast, whether it's Spotify or you listen to it on Apple Podcasts. Just click share, put it in your family WhatsApp group. Say, listen to this and make sure you respect family my wishes. Needs. I'd like to be a donor. It's as easy as that.
It is as easy as that. And I know it's sometimes, it can be a hard conversation to people to have. Like, you don't want to be a bit morbid and be like, oh, by the way, I just want to have this talk with you. Yeah. Like, if I die, like, your family probably be like, oh, what?
I've been putting off doing me will, Jodie.
And it's not a nice thing to have to think about. It's got to be done, because if that's your wishes, your family, not like disrespectfully, like say, oh, no, I don't want, but obviously your family are grieving at the time.
Don't make them make a choice.
Exactly. So if they know, then mm-hmm. they know that that's what's happening, and it's just a case of obviously having to say goodbye. Whereas if they don't know, they've got to then make that decision.
Yeah.
Or they've got to go, no, I didn't know that they were an organ donor. Like, I don't think they was. I'm pulling them out.
So personally then, will you be able to be a donor?
So personally, I was on the list, but unfortunately I can't be.
I was thinking.
Because I've had a transplant, I'm also on the medication that I'm on and things like that.
So
it can affect everything. Oh. So unfortunately, I like your blood and everything, it affects all. So I can't even do like stem cell donation, and like I can't give blood anymore. I used to go every 12 weeks and give blood.
Yeah.
As soon as I found out about my heart condition 11 years ago, I had to stop giving blood because I knew I had the heart condition. Not that you can pass anything through blood, but it's just I was on heart medication and things like that. And there's just if the
certain medication.
So people they might actually not be able to be an organ donor, but or give blood or anything like that. But the majority of people would know that if they had a certain condition, they'd know they wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah.
But the majority, everyone else can.
So let's rewind back then. So your first chance at a new life and a brand new heart.
Yeah.
Is snatched away from you and you're prepped ready for surgery and they go, actually not today. How did that hit you?
I was absolutely devastated. It actually hit me harder than I thought it would, because they do tell you that that can happen. So when you get the phone call, I was like, oh my God, and I was shaking, I was crying, it was everything. But on the way to the hospital, because I had to go to Manchester, it's Withenshawe in Manchester, on the way there, I was thinking to myself, don't get yourself too thingied up. They've got to check the heart and that first. So I was like really preparing myself just in case.
And it comes with risks. So I imagine you're having that conversation, but also at the back of your head, you're thinking, what if this is the last drive I ever do? What if something goes wrong?
Exactly.
That's such a strange place.
Obviously, your head is all over the place.
You want it, but you don't want it.
It's literally like an emotional roller coaster.
It could be
it's
the start
so
of a new life. It could be the end
the
of
the end of
life.
Everything, yeah.
Oh, I've got goosebumps.
Honestly, it's so hard. So like, I've got a nearly 3-year-old now. And at the time, he not long turned 2. And I got the call in the August. And I had to wake him up on my way to the hospital. My dad come to
get me. So you go there and then?
You get the call and they say, you've got 2 hours to get to us.
Wow.
So like they actually said to me, I had 4 hours to sort of get myself prepared and get to the hospital. But I had to get someone to come. The baby was in bed, so I had to get someone to come to my house to watch the baby. Mm-hmm. And then obviously get all my stuff too. I had a bag ready already.
And get
to Manchester and then get sorted. So, but I had to wake the baby up and have that conversation with him of like I'd sort of explained to him that mummy needs a new heart, and I had this book made for him and everything to explain. Yeah. So it was like 6 short stories, and it was the book was about him, and it was about him coming to the hospital to help all the doctors and nurses help mummy get a new heart, and that's what all the stories were about. So we read it to him every night, so he sort of in a way understood that I had to go to the hospital. So I woke him up and I said, it's time, mummy's got to go to the hospital now, I'm going to get my new heart. And he was just like looking at me, and he was like, okay mum, I'll see you later. And I was like, I'll see you very soon. But like, how do you have that conversation with a 2-year-old? Because like, he's very clever for his age, but still they don't fully understand like what is going on. So like obviously kids haven't got a concept of time, obviously. So I was just sort of like, mummy will be back very soon. I promise you, I'll be back very soon.
But then mummy comes back without the heart.
But then I literally came back without the heart. And then I had to have that conversation with him. I was like, oh, it didn't quite go ahead this time. So he's just like looking at me as if like, mum, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But luckily enough, he was just like, okay, mum, and then carried on playing.
It's all these pieces to the jigsaw. But it is, how
Everyone's affected, And as I say, I just struggled so much having to tell him.
Yeah.
And then obviously it got taken away, and then it was like, and then I had to have another conversation with them. And then I was thinking to myself, next time I get this call again, I've then got to have the conversation again with them. And that is like the hardest conversation. Like, I can't even explain to anyone how hard that is to sort of, in a way, say goodbye to your child, because you don't know if you're going to come back.
We obviously, we can't relate. So I imagine 99.9% of people listening to this can't relate to what you went through. The only way I can relate to that is if anyone's ever found a lump.
Yeah.
And you find a lump and you've diagnosed yourself in your head.
And your heart just sinks, doesn't
and
it?
Every time you look at your child, Josie,
you're
in bits. Because what are they going to do?
What are they going to do?
If this is the worst, if the worst case scenario is actually happening to me, what's this baby? No one's going to love this baby more than you. Baby.
Yeah, and they're not going to love anyone else more than you, the mum. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, it's just the hardest thing. Like, like, I know people wasn't, like, no one was in my shoes, but any woman with a child...
Yeah.
If you just think of putting yourself in that situation, you will know exactly how you feel, because instantly you just get this sick feeling.
And with you, you're doing it to live your rest of your life.
To be with him.
In the best condition.
Exactly.
To be there.
Because beforehand, even though he was only two, for them first 2 years of his life, I struggled. I was out of breath all the time. I couldn't hardly do anything with him.
Yeah.
Even to pick him up would drain me because my heart just wasn't functioning properly.
Well, I want to come back to the successful operation at the end. So while we're here, let's just gravitate towards your first moment of realisation that you knew something was wrong and how you were diagnosed. So I think that was like 11
about
years?
About 11 years ago now,
Talk us through it, Josie.
So I actually didn't get any thing of realisation until it was just like a bang and it hit me. So I went to the gym and I was running on the treadmill.
I just collapsed.
And then I got rushed to the hospital. And
so you woke up that morning, felt normal?
Felt complete. I'd been to Thailand for four and a half weeks, came back, and 2 days later I was like, right, I need to get back into the gym. I've been away for so long, whatever. And I was in the gym all the time.
How old were you?
What was I? I was 23.
Baby.
So I was still only young. Yeah. So as I said, I'd just been travelling around Thailand for 4.5 weeks. Yeah. Came back, everything had been amazing. I'd done a couple of workouts while I was away, but obviously you're just away on holiday. You don't. So I came back, I was like, right, I need to get back in the gym. Went to the gym, perfectly fine. And then I was just running, but I was doing like sprints. So I was like doing interval sprints. So I was like running fast, and then I'd like jump onto, I know you're not meant to jump onto the sides, but I'd jump onto the sides,
exactly what you mean.
Have a bit of a minute, and then I'd jump back on again, start running. And I jumped off and I was like, wow, my heart is like pounding. But I thought, oh, must just be that I'm fit because I've been away.
Yeah.
I'll be fine, just keep pushing.
And the drinking, the party, but I am one to
like just push myself. Like, I'll just keep going because I've done sport my whole life.
Yeah.
So I was always one to just be like, you're fine, just get on with this, keep going. So I was like, just push through it, you'll be fine. Mm. And then jump back on again, started running. And then next thing I knew, I opened my eyes and I was just lying on the floor. But I could feel my heart, my body was doing this. Because my heart was going that quick.
It was physically moving.
Physically, I was shaking on the floor and I was thinking, shit, what is going on? Like something. And then I just felt like that. And every time I tried to sit up, I was going really lightheaded and I was like, shit, I'm going to faint again.
Mm.
And then I'd lie down again and I was like, I need to get out of this gym, because you know when you feel like everyone's staring at you, and I was like, oh, I need to get out of this gym.
So you picked yourself up?
So I literally, I was like, right, sit up a minute. So I sat myself up and I felt dead dizzy and I was like, I'm okay. This little old fella, I went to the gym first thing in the morning. It was like 5:30 in the morning, because that's the time I used to always train. And this little old fella I'd see every morning and I'd be like, hiya mate, and we'd talk and everything. So we come over to him, he's like, James, are you all right? What's the matter? And I was like, oh, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. Like, wooden thingy. Mm. I was like, oh, I've been away, haven't I? I just feel a bit. And he was like, yeah, all right. If you need anything, just give me a shout. I went, yeah, all right. And then I was, oh, I'm getting off anyway. See you later. And I walked out of the gym into my car. I got to the car and I was nearly falling. And I was like, so I lay on the back seat of the car and put my feet on like up against the windows. And I thought, you know, when you feel dizzy and if you put your feet up and it's meant to like circulate blood again, I was like, I'll be fine in a minute. And my heart was still going. So I rang my brother, and luckily enough, they lived around the corner. And he came round to me and he was like, Jodie, what's the matter? I said, Brian, I don't know, but like, you need to take me somewhere. Because he took me home first. And my mum was panicking. She was like, no, we need to. So we rang an ambulance and they were like, it's going to take like so many hours or whatever. And it was just, so in the end, we went to the doctors and she was like, oh, you've had a panic attack. You're all right. Like, don't, because it started calming down a little bit. And I was like, no, this is not a panic attack. Like, I know what a panic attack is. Like, this is something else. She done my blood pressure and all. She was like, oh, it's a little bit high. But like, and then all of a sudden it started racing again, my heart. And I literally fell forward and my head just, I just headbutted the desk and she just like looked and I'd passed out again.
Wow.
And my mum was like, this was not a panic attack, like what?
Yeah.
So anyway, she was like, and my mum went, I'm taking her to the hospital. Literally, I come round again. She threw me in the car and I went to the hospital and I was in the Royal for 5 days and they'd done these tests and said, you've got this genetic heart condition. You were born with it and I didn't know about it.
See, that's quite common, isn't it now? I'd like to say that's the only time I've heard that, but I've heard that a few times.
And it's very common in a lot of people who are more athletic as well. So a lot of people who are more, who are really fit, it tends to happen to them more because they strain their heart a little bit more. So any underlying conditions will actually show.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But obviously I didn't know that until I found out.
Because there's something, isn't there, with teenagers? Is it just teenage boys? Don't know, gang, you'll have to Google this one. But where they go to bed and then you just don't wake up.
Well, it's sad, it's called.
Is that what it's called? Tell me more.
Sudden arrhythmic death syndrome, basically. And there's all different heart conditions that are in this sort of sad category.
Yeah.
The ones I had was one of them. I had ARVC, so it's arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. So it was my right ventricle was like, I had thick scar tissue. So the signals from my brain to my heart weren't sort of getting there properly. So the right side of my heart just was like flickering. It wasn't pumping the blood to my lungs. So that's why I struggled with my breathing and things like that. But there's all different cardiomyopathies, which is your heart is like, has grown like bigger than what it should do. And then you sort of get like arrhythmias where your heart rate sort of goes all over the place and things like that. And you go into like AF, atrial fibrillation and things like that. So that's what it is. So it's they call it SADS, and it's a lot, and it does happen to a lot of boys for some. I don't know why.
No.
I don't know why that is a thing, but it does happen to a lot of boys.
I remember it happened to a kid that lived by us, about 15, when I was much younger, and it's you know, one of those things that stick with you. So every time you read about it, or you see a story on the internet, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like I see and hear about this all the time.
It's a lot more. I feel like since I found out, but it's like when you get a new car.
Yeah.
You never see the car. You get it. You're like, this is a new car. Yep. No one's got it, and then you see it everywhere. So it's like when you're in that like thing, you sort of know more.
Or you miss your period and there's brands
then,
everywhere.
Exactly. And you're like, oh my God, this is a sign.
Exactly.
Literally, yeah.
I'm just looking at producer Dan now because I know he's going to be like fully intensely listening to this. Yeah. He's got a young lad.
Oh God.
And he's just like, it's this kind of knowledge.
It is, it's just, and you've got to know.
I'm lucky to get from you first, Dan, so thank you.
And do you know what? This is one of the things that I sort of want to sort of try and get out there. And I've actually started, it's still in the process of being, like I've had to apply for it basically. So I've put a petition out and I want to try and get heart screenings made like a heart screening like program out there, so that, not mandatory, because obviously people have got their own choices, but it's like, you know, like when you, like we get cervical cancer screenings and things like that, so it made a thing, so like say from like 16 to the age of 35, like people should get a letter and you should be able to go and get a heart screening. So you get an ECG and an echocardiogram, and if they see the slightest thing, you get sent for more tests.
Yeah.
If there's no problems, they say, no, you're okay. But obviously if there's any symptoms of anything, you go to your doctors. But that's not a thing.
It all costs money.
Exactly.
And as much as we all know, along with so many other things, something like this would prevent
all the deaths that are happening, and it would actually prevent... Transplants cost a fortune.
Would it be financially beneficial?
It would actually be better, but obviously making a big programme, putting it out there, obviously it's not a thing. It's a nightmare to try and fight for.
It's the same for, I've known quite a few girls, different outcomes with breast cancer, and if they have been screened, breast cancer, but they go, oh, is it in your lymph nodes, wherever, wherever? Oh, ring your bell, you've had your treatment. Let's just do a full body check and just see if it's anywhere else.
Exactly.
Because again,
it can travel
so many times, and so many people I know personally have gone on with the life 12 months later. You terminal,
back,
you didn't realize exactly. It was in your liver, it was in your bones, it's in your brain,
and it's not fair. And it should be, yeah, it does cost money, but it saves lives,
yeah.
And it should be in the long run,
surely,
exactly.
We've got to try it to see if it does save money,
yeah.
Like you say,
I honestly think it would, because a lot of over the 11 years, the amount of tests and operations that I've had to have, like that could have been prevented, because the condition I had progressively got worse as you got older. But I found out that actually too much exercise made it worse.
So at 16, you could have changed your lifestyle.
So I could have not exercised. I could still have exercised, but not have exercised as much.
Yeah.
And I probably could, because after finding out I had a genetic condition, obviously my family had to get checked, because no one in my family knew about anything.
Did anyone else?
My dad and my brother have got the same thing and they didn't know.
So what does it mean
for
them?
So there's four stages of the condition I had. I was in stage four. I was like the worst, but I had like a red herring, they called it, from my mum, that sort of went with the gene from my dad and made mine as worse as it did. Oh. And obviously all the sport on top didn't help. But so my brother and my dad are in stage one. So theirs is very manageable.
Yeah.
It doesn't really cause them any problems, but it's there and it gets regular. To get regular checks.
Really, you'd have known.
But if we were to get exactly, so say from the age of 16 or slightly earlier, maybe age of 14, I know it's hard because obviously everyone's heart, it's at a certain age that it's fully developed.
Yeah.
So once it's, I know you can't get screened any earlier than that, but maybe once you do get to that point where your heart is fully developed, you're like, right, okay, here's your heart screen, and go and get your heart screen, and know everything's fine, carry on.
And knowing what we know, I think late teens is probably a good start point.
Yeah, because it does tend to be mid to late teens that, like, more recent, it's coming out.
Yeah.
And as I say, I was 23, but I was at the point where I was already in heart failure at 23. If I would have got a heart screen earlier on, they might have found it and gone, you know what, we need to monitor this, and kept it a little bit, like,
yeah, controlled,
not more controlled,
planned surgery, treatments, that you could have taken in your stride that wouldn't have stopped you in your tracks. Yeah, this
but is. Mine got to the point where I found out at 23, it was like the worst point possible. I got an ICD put in my chest, which is an implantable defibrillator.
Yeah,
so I had that into my heart, and I had like a box in my chest, and that was in case I had the arrhythmia again, so, and it would automatically shock me.
Yeah,
and 2 years after having, 2 years after having it all put in, I had another episode and I got 12 shocks off the device. So I was lucky I had it.
Yeah.
But having 12 shocks, defibrillator shocks, and I was awake, is just the most horrendous pain. Like, I can't even explain it.
I can't even imagine. What does that feel like, Josie?
But when you get it in and they tell you, they say it's like a horse kicking you, but how do you know what a horse feels like kicking you? Like, do you know what I mean?
I wouldn't even want to imagine
exactly.
Like getting boosted
but
by a
honest
yours.
To God, that's what they said. But it's
12,
like
12 kicks
so it was like a shock. So I got like six in a row, and then it sort of calmed down a little bit. And then about an hour later, another six, and then they had to put me asleep to try and control my heart. So I probably would have carried on getting more, but
that's
I got to the point where it was shocking me. I looked at my cardiologist because I'd been rushed to the hospital again, and I went, will you turn this fucking thing off? Because it was just, and I was like, and it was just the worst pain. Like, I can't
did it
even
feel like a horse kicking you in the chest?
Well, I don't know what a bloody horse feels like, do I? But it was horrendous.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely horrendous. Like, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. I swear to God, it was awful.
I just
like,
don't
like
know
put
what
it
to
this
say
way,
to
my, when I was, so it happened when I got the shocks, I was in the walking centre and I had tonsillitis and I went to get antibiotics. And because my heart couldn't cope with, like, when I get any infections or anything, it couldn't cope. So if I got sick, I had to go to the doctor straight away and be on antibiotics, because if it got any worse, it was really dangerous for me. But at the time, I didn't know this. And I got tonsillitis, went to the walking centre, but I was on my own, drove to the walking centre. And as I got into the car park, I went all funny. But luckily enough, I just pulled in the car park, parked up, and I was like, shit, I've just nearly passed out behind the wheel.
Yeah.
So then I walked in the walking, ended up collapsing, and then having six shocks. The ambulance came. And then I went to Broad Green, got another six shocks. But my dad was holding my hand at this time. And they were like, you all need to leave the room. My dad was like, I'm not going anywhere. Yeah. Held my hand while it was shocking me. And he said he felt the shocks through his hands. And they were bad. So he couldn't even imagine, because that was like a secondary shock.
Yeah.
So he said, I can't even imagine how I felt, because I could feel it. And It was painful.
So is this the day where they said, right?
No, so this was still 8 years ago. This was 2 years after getting it all done.
So you went years and years after this?
So I got
not knowing if it's going to happen
again. It could have happened at any time. So I lived with this in my chest. So after having all them shocks, that my life like completely changed then, because I was petrified to do anything.
Yeah.
I was scared of, I was scared to go asleep overnight because I didn't think I'd wake up the next morning. I was scared just general day to day walking around. I was like, am I walking too fast? Is my heart going to, and I was petrified in case that was going to shock me. It was, so for the 8 years, well, for 11 years, but for like a solid 8 years, I was petrified to do anything.
So when did they turn to you and say, right, we need to put you on the donor list?
So I had another episode in December 2024. And I got taken to hospital again, and I got a, what's it called? They give me a defib shock, but they done it. A cardioversion.
Yeah.
So basically they had to sort of put me, sort of make me drowsy and give me them, and it was to get my heart back into rhythm because my device that I had in just wasn't doing the right thing.
It done you well for about 8 years.
But it wasn't sort of bringing my heart rate down. So I was just in this really fast, and I had a really bad episode, and I was like, I was vomiting, I'd gone blue and everything. Like me blood pressure had gone really low, and the ambulance took me to the hospital, and my consultant just come into me and he just said, I'm really sorry, there's literally nothing else we can do for you.
I'm thinking of your mum, thinking your dad. To sit there,
it was just me and my partner were there at the time, and then I had to obviously ring my mum and dad and say, you need to come in. And then he basically just said to me, we need to refer you to Withenshaw. And I was like, what's Withenshaw? I don't know what it is. He said, it's the heart transplant hospital. And I just like went sick.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, it's got to that point. And you never think, like at the very, very start, he was like, worst case scenario, it can get to this, but this might be when you're in your 60s or whatever. And I was like, oh, right, okay. Thinking nothing of it, and not knowing that at 33, they were going to tell me that I was getting a heart transplant.
So they take you in there, they test you.
So I get a 3-day assessment, and they just said, yeah, you are in complete heart failure.
It's this or nothing.
It's this or nothing. Mm. It's basically this or, yeah, you won't be here. And they didn't sort of give me a time, but they just said, you are in complete heart failure. So that means we don't know how long you've got, but it's not a long time.
So then this brings us to your false alarm. You get false alarm, yeah. That falls through. Yeah. You go back home, you explain it to your son.
Yeah.
You live through the, well, will I get one, will I not? Yeah. How long am I going to live?
Because they can tell you that the waiting list can be anything from like days to years.
But you get the call.
So then in October, I wasn't feeling, I started feeling even worse, and I went into them and said, listen, I'm not feeling right. So they'd done this other test on me, and they were like, yeah, you've gone worse. Your heart stopped, like basically not functioning at all on the right side. So then I got admitted into the hospital. So then it was basically, you're going in and you either come out with a new heart or you don't come out at all. So then I had to have the talk with my son again and say, right, mummy's going into hospital.
And he's
But
three
I've got to live there. Point? No, he's still two. He's only three in June this year. So I was like, mummy's going to hospital. I can still see you. I'm not getting the heart just yet, but I'm waiting for one. So then I had to go on this drip, and that was basically helping my heart function properly.
And that's 24 hours
And
away,
that was just 24. So I had to walk around with this little drip stand and whatever.
So your whole life's completely changed.
Gone from, so I was living in the hospital at this point.
Five in the morning.
Yeah.
To being attached to a gym 24 hours a day, away from your son. Yeah. Trapped in a hospital, waiting for
literally
a call.
Literally living in hospital.
Or
I'm not going to be here. Yeah. But luckily enough, I went on the list on the 16th of October, something like that. And on the 5th of November, they actually woke me, the nurse come in and woke me up.
Do you know whose heart it was? Do you get any information?
The only thing I know at the minute, it was a 40-year-old woman. That's all I know. And I'm hoping, I am in the process of writing a letter to the family. Yeah. I'm not allowed to know anything else at the minute, but I'm in the process of writing a letter to the family, which I don't know who the family are. I've got to sort of write the letter, give it to the hospital. They give it to like a middleman, which is like an agency, which then give it to the family. Yeah. And then if they were to write back, it's the same process. But I'm hoping to find out more.
That is a wonderful thing to do. I think whoever the family are behind this brilliant 40-year-old woman.
Amazing.
To receive a letter from you to know that they child's heart is keeping you alive and keeping you.
And that's what I want
to tell them.
Yeah, and that's what I want to tell them. I want to tell them how grateful I am, because I wouldn't be here without that donor.
Yeah.
And that's why, like the starter said, organ donation is so important, because it does save lives. Mm. And the amount of people I met in that hospital, who a lot of the people wear lungs, a heart transplant and a little less, like they don't need to get as many, but the amount of people that were in there waiting for transplants, and some of them have been waiting for over a year in hospital, and it's just like
away from the family,
away from families, and
then look at you,
struggle, and look like I was so lucky like to not be waiting that long, but like I was really lucky, but obviously I had the complications after the surgery, and at one point my family did get told that I wasn't going to make the night, and we don't know what happens because they literally said we've given her everything. And she is, we don't think she's going to make it. And then, don't know what it is, they said it's only a homebody that can do this. And whatever I did that night, obviously I was in a coma, don't know. But whatever I did that night, I pulled through. And as I say, here I am now, but not without, I might look great and I feel, honestly, I feel unbelievable. I feel amazing. And I'm so, so grateful for that. And that's why I want to write to my donor's family and I want them to know that. And if they didn't get back to me, that's their choice. And I wouldn't blame them. I wouldn't be, because obviously they've lost a family member. And I know that's so hard for them. But I want them to know that I have got their family member's heart, but I will make sure that I look after it.
We spoke about a jigsaw race at the start, and this is like the final piece. Even if they don't contact you back, they're not obliged.
And I'm still here with my son, and that's because of their daughter or their mum or whoever it may be. And obviously I want to let them know how grateful I am for that. And as I say, feel amazing, and I've got a quality life back again, which I didn't have. And that is thanks to her. But yeah, I did have a lot of complications, and one of them being on the ECMO machine that I was on, that was keeping me alive. It obviously takes the blood out your body and then it pumps it back in, and I had organ failure at the time, so it was pumping the blood back in and all that blood was going to the organs to try and save them. So unfortunately my feet weren't getting blood to them, and unfortunately I got necrosis of both of my feet, and I got told that I was getting both my legs amputated below my knee. And I got two of my fingers as well.
And did that happen?
Yeah, and now I've got prosthetics. So in January, so I was still in hospital. So I got that in the November. And thankfully, just before Christmas, I pulled through everything and everything went amazing. Not after getting pneumonia as well, of course. I did put my family through it, like, but luckily enough, I pulled through everything. And just before Christmas, I ended up getting moved from intensive care onto the ward. And after 9 weeks on Christmas Eve, I seen my son for the first time after 9 weeks, and it was just the best Christmas present, along with my heart, that anyone could give you.
I love that you're here to tell the story.
And so am I. I'm made up to be here because
your message,
and that's
so
why I want
clear.
To get my story out there, because it's not just about talking about me and what I've done, and it's getting out there how important this is, and like obviously how grateful I also am. And yeah, it's just that's what my story's about, and that's why I want to get it out there to everyone.
You've convinced me. I'm going to be sending a WhatsApp to my family immediately. It's as simple as that. You don't need to fill forms in. You don't need to sit down with anyone. You don't have to log onto a website. Just make sure your family know that you wish to save lives.
Just have that talk.
When the time comes, take that weight from them so they don't have to think about it. A simple WhatsApp message today to your family WhatsApp group could save many lives.
Many.
Thank you so much, Jodie. What a joy speaking to you.
Thank you.
And the happy ending at the end.
Oh, God, yeah. Loads of stuff to look forward to. Yeah. And just before I go, I'm actually doing, on the 31st of May,
go on,
I'm doing the Manchester 10K. And I've been raising money for British Heart Foundation. And I've still got a Just Giving page if people could support me. I'm nearly at $7,000. And I really want to try and make it to that because it's just a brilliant cause.
We'll make it to 10. Let's round it off.
I really hope, honestly, everyone. It would be amazing because, as I say, I've finally got given me prosthetics. I've had them for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And I am walking about on them, but I am still a bit unsteady. But I'm doing some of it in my wheelchair, but I'm also walking some of it as well. And I never thought I was going to get to this. And this is just a little thing that I've had to keep me going and get me through all the rehab and everything like that. So yeah, I'm doing that in 10 days time. So I would love if people can support
me. I'll make it so easy for you. So you can find Jodie. She'll be tagged on Instagram. Just search Ladies Liverpool and you'll search her out there. We'll attach the link. Find me, Leanne Campbell, as well on Facebook. It'll be on there with a link there. everywhere you find Ladies of Liverpool, the podcast, you will find Josie's face and you will find that link. A five from all of you. I know the stats. We'll smash that target and the rest.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Subscribe now
via the iTunes Store. Hear more from the Ladies of Liverpool via ladiesofliverpool.com.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses, plus free delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number. To a good life's sleep.